Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast, special Earth Day edition. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to have you joining me on Earth Day 2021. It's obvious that every day is Earth Day, but that is such a bumper sticker cliche. Are there anything as bumper stickers anymore? You don't see bumper stickers as much as you used to in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. Bumper stickers were a thing. I mean, that's how you expressed yourself. And every now and again, I'll see some, you know, shit bucket car that's from 35, 40 years ago drive around a bunch of bumper stickers on the back, but that's something you don't see anymore. Anyway, Earth Day is every day, and if it was a bumper sticker, you know, it's got to be one somewhere for sure. This is a very strange episode for me. Let me just explain. I don't want to do this show. I don't want to talk about this stuff anymore. I don't want to talk about the obvious that's so buried in the absurd, it's getting even more absurd when it comes to the environment. All the progress we've made since 1970, which was the first official Earth Day notwithstanding, it's just old to me that this constantly is a problem, meaning the plastics in the ocean and the overfishing and, you know, the climate change, people arguing. And I sit back after doing this work for so many years in relative to the planet, which is 4.65 billion years old. I've been only doing this for about 35, 40 years, so it's a blip. It's not even a bat of an eye in the cosmic sense, but it just wears me out. And nothing more than climate change and the battle between whether or not global warming is man-made or not. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. You know, we have this part of our DNA, which is so connected to denial, it's not even funny. And denial, not the river in Egypt, but denial like, how could we cause any problems? It's the bane of our existence. Every man-made, woman-made, and human-made problem carries that DNA piece as well, with denial attached to it, that somehow we're not responsible. Like, who's doing this? Aliens from another planet instructing this? You know, when the Flint water was so bad you couldn't drink it, that wasn't done by anybody but humans and people who wanted to cut corners. And to be clear, it was, you know, a cost-cutting measure for the city of Flint that would have cost them about $100 a day to make it safe, and they decided, nah, it's too much money, and so you're literally up shit creek. So now there's a big distrust of people, you know, in Flint that still don't want to drink the water. I don't blame them, even though they've spent millions to clean all that up. What if they'd have spent the $100 the first time around a day? You wouldn't have this problem. Prevention, especially when it comes to environmental things, is everything. But I still, like I said, I'm pushing myself to do this because on Earth Day, I feel like I need to say something, but I've been saying the same somethings for over two decades, going on three. And I wonder if it matters to some degree. You know, I did the Earth Matters with Bill Curtis series, a radio show for 3 years. I wrote 300 episodes, scripted them out, researched them. Bill put his formidable pipes on them. And the whole idea was in a minute or so to give people information and inspiration and maybe educate them a little bit to something that's going on in the world they don't hear about. And in terms of radio, it was successful. It was on for 3 years. We had syndication. It was wonderful and good. We never made a dime off it. Not a dime. We had some sponsors. I shouldn't say that totally, but when they figure in production costs, it sure wasn't a profit-making expedition. And we didn't do it for that. But in radio, everything's got to be paid for, so you have to figure those things out. Matt Cummings, who is a guy that I worked with at Oprah Radio, is the operations manager at WCPT Radio in Chicago, and he actually gave us airspace for those for 3 years. It was quite the thing that he did, and you know, we were eventually able to get some sponsors and stuff a little bit here and there. But in radio, everything is about the bottom line dollar, and so even those are done creatively at high level, and the production values are great. You know, it has to be something that's sustainable. And while 36 months sounds sustainable in the big scheme of things with radio, we're talking you need years of this stuff for people to really attach themselves to it. So the good news in that, Earth Matters still lives on. Every one of them is in my trusty, dusty Dell laptop here. and I put them in the Bridge radio show that I do, the international show, and that's a good thing. And I have access to those, obviously. And you're going to actually hear the first ever Earth Matters we did back in 2014 about water, because I think that is the most pressing issue now of our time. And so you'll hear that in just a few minutes, and that's a little bit self-explanatory. But when you start thinking about all the elemental pieces that go into our lives, you know, everything else falls in line behind our life support system, or at least it should. We've gotten away with a lot for a very long time. And that is part of that denial thing that, wow, you know, it's like somebody smoking for decades and thinking that somehow it's not going to catch up to them, or anything else that's harmful to the body. You're going to be the one that escapes all that. And when it catches up, you go, wait a minute, what's going on here? I think our environment is much the same. And while there are 7 billion people crawling all over this planet that is very old, it does have systems that are in place to help clean itself, but we're depleting those as well. And look, I am not a doomsayer, as you know, has been brought up in the past by people that, you know, it's the end of the world kind of things. I think the earth will always go on. We're the ones in trouble, but we're doing it to ourselves. So when I think about the thousands of shows I've done over the years on environmental things, and I think about the countless blogs that I've written and all that's connected to environmental work. Matter of fact, my actual degree is environmental awareness and interpretation. It was a degree that I was designed myself when I went back to college after being in the service, because I realized a couple things. One is that just giving people information isn't enough. You have to somehow give them an awareness. And in order to get awareness, you have to interpret things that most people can't see. So that's why, for example, Annie Crawley, who is known around the world as Ocean Annie, an award-winning photographer, an oceanographer, and teaches scuba diving and just is a huge advocate for the planet and the ocean particularly. Matter of fact, in my opinion, she is the female Jacques Cousteau. She is on that level of bringing attention to the underwater world. And she's also a graduate of the same high school that I went to, sure, is in Chicago, a little later than I did, but still the same. She does this work, and I find that interesting. Two city kids doing all this work on the environment. Both of us grew up on the streets, right? So when it comes to the water supply, I think of my first real wake-up call in that arena was way back in the late 60s, for sure, early 70s, when my dad, who was a great guy, you know, wasn't out to, you know, to harm the environment per se, he would change the oil in his car 3 or 4 times a year. Usually every time the seasons changed, my dad would change the oil in the car. And he would pop off the oil filter, put it in a little can, and then he would drain the oil basically onto the street. And then he would wash it all down into the sewer. And in his mind, that's what the sewer was for, garbage and waste disposal. And no thought as to what happened to the water mixing with the oil right below the surface of the street in that sewer. And where would it go, right? So I remember helping him as a little kid and loved to work on cars and wrenches and things like that. And vivid memory of one day saying to my dad, hey, Dad, where does that oil go that you're putting in the ground there? He said, well, I'm not putting it in the ground. It's going into the sewer. Because everything goes into the sewer. And then I kind of remember asking something, well, how much, you know, what happens once it goes in the sewer? Where does it go? And he really didn't have an answer. Well, it probably goes, you know, into a tunnel somewhere. Well, then where's the tunnel go? Well, as we know now, of course, back then, the tunnel went right into the Chicago River. And before they had a lot of these safeguards in place to clean water and do things like that, that's how it ended up. Matter of fact, if you're of a certain vintage, you might remember in 1969, in Cuyahoga, the river was on fire because that was what they did with their stuff too. It was normal back then for everything to go into the water system. And I remember him saying, oh, don't worry about it, you know, and there's people will take care of that. And my response was, well, Dad, what if there's like 300 dads today washing oil into the sewer? Doesn't it? That's not a good thing, is it? And that was my, it was a little, for him, it might have been a little light bulb moment. For me, it was a big light bulb moment because I somehow made the connection between my father, who was just doing what he's always done during his life, again, with no malice aforethought, to wash the oil into the sewer. It's just where you put it. And for me, I realized that, you know, again, times 300 or 3,000 or 3 million people doing this, this is not good. And when that river caught on fire, it was made headline news, burning, the river is on fire. And many people think that was the catalyst for Earth Day itself, that people really had had enough. Again, if you're of a certain vintage, you can remember people literally throwing garbage out their car windows. When they're done eating, you just throw garbage out the window. And that mentality was so ridiculous to me. You don't see that very often anymore. You may see a cigarette fly out the window now and again, but for the most part, people have stopped that. But it took, you know, campaigns to make America beautiful. Because you have to tell people this stuff. Is it because, obviously, again, there's that whole blind spot of what we're doing. And to me, what's done on the micro is done on the macro. So if you have the mindset back then that just throwing stuff out of the window is okay, then you really don't care about the big picture stuff getting messed up. Now, as reluctant as I am to do these shows, and again, I guess maybe I'm looking for, it's on me. I mean, I get that. I've also come to a great realization that this is a zero-sum game. I think that we're going to call a draw on this, that we'll do just enough not to totally screw up our species and the planet, and we'll always kind of be at a 50-50 point. You know, there's more carbon in the air now than there's ever been in recorded history. It's not good. And we've yet to see the total effects of that. You know, in parts of our country, they're building seawalls higher up because they're anticipating the oceans rising a little bit and the salt water and the seawater mixing together. I mean, it is mind-numbing and mind-boggling what we've done in the last 150, 200 years as it regards to the Industrial Revolution and how that has played out in the environment. So there was a time where I would sit down and actually have arguments with people about this, and then that time has come and gone. It's just a waste of time. You won't convince people of that thing. You know, like my dad, to his credit, eventually, you know, got big buckets underneath there, and then he would store the oil under our front porch. I don't know if that was any better. It was like a super fun cleanup site after a while. But at least he did that. And that was something he did on his own volition. So jumping back to the Earth Matters radio shows that we did, Bill and I, our hope was that people would be like my dad, that they would hear something that would inspire them to do something or stop doing something. One of the Earth Matters shows we did had to do with microbeads, polyethylene microbeads in Lake Erie especially, but in all the Great Lakes. And scientists came across these beads, polyethylene. They're not supposed to be in the water. They're chemically created. And what had happened is these polyethylene beads for years were used as scrubbing elements and ingredients in facial scrubs. And that's what, and when you washed your face, if you used them and they went right down the drain, not unlike the oil that ran into the sewer and out they went into the pipes. And because the filters, you know, didn't catch them, these things were so small, they would go out into the lakes and fish would eat them. And who eats the fish? I'll wait. We do. So when you see this type of stuff happen, all it means is that there has to be an adjustment somewhere, but you have to have the awareness for the adjustment at all. We aired that little episode probably in 2015, 2016, somewhere in there. And some congressman heard it in Chicago and ran it to the legislature to ban polyethylene beads. And it wasn't just us because there was a couple of articles out. But when Bill Curtis speaks, the whole world listens. So we had that going for us. And introduced legislation to ban polyethylene beads in Illinois. And eventually, before Barack Obama left office, he made it a nationwide ban on polyethylene beads. Don't want to put people who make polyethylene beads out of business. But we also don't want to be ingesting carcinogens through our fish. So what's happened since then? They found natural ingredients to put in scrubs. And they just disappear. They're biodegradable. But that didn't happen until there was some leverage put on them. No one even thought of it. The awareness wasn't there. This also reminds me of, I think, the biggest collaborative effort on behalf of ourselves as a species on this planet. Not the dominant one, I don't think, because I don't think we're that bright. But unfortunately, the ones that make the biggest impact is the whole thing to do with CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. And if you remember back in the day, in the 60s and 70s again, but before that, these were around as well. These were CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, were propellants for like air conditioners and in aerosol spray cans and things like that. And some guy figured out, you can go look it up online. I'm not going to spend, this time we have here as a full-blown lesson on the Montreal Protocol. But once they figured out what was happening with this ozone hole opening and closing that lets in too much of the ultraviolet rays that heat things up and cause skin cancers, they figured out that it was these chlorofluorocarbons were not dissipating, not unlike those beads in the water. Now they were just going up and eating a hole in the ozone layer, which is the protective layer of the biosphere of Earth. Not good. Not good. Not supposed to be a hole in there. This was a man-made and woman-made and human-made problem, right? So once they figured that out, they had to ban the CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons. It was a big deal. The Montreal Protocol was signed, where every nation on Earth says we will stop making these because it's not good for our species long term. Of course, the people that made the CFCs didn't like it, but guess what? I'll wait. They found other ways to create propellants. We still have refrigerators. We still have air conditioners. They found ways that didn't harm the environment. The awareness was there. I don't think you'd ever get that done today. Wouldn't happen. Too much division. Too many trampling on somebody's rights somewhere because there's the hole somewhere that I can't see. I don't think it's real. The main driver for the Montreal Protocol was the Iron Lady Margaret Thatcher in the UK. And she was a scientist. Big time. And she, once she got the data, she started calling the leaders of the world to say, this is what's going on. And she took the lead. Matter of fact, she actually got a hold of Ronald Reagan and said, I can't imagine how I used to do a pretty good Ronald Reagan imitation, but I'm not going to do it here. Not even going to attempt it. But she got a hold of President Reagan and said, this is what's going on. And he kind of shoved it off. He pushed it away and pushed it away until she got to the point where she said, it's going to increase this type of activity with, if we leave it as is, skin cancers are going to go up big time. Ronald Reagan had to deal with skin cancer in his life, and that all of a sudden became personal to him. All of a sudden it mattered because it was now something that he's had to deal with, and it made sense to him. So, of course, Ronnie got on board right out of the gate. And then as soon as the United States and Great Britain were involved and everybody else fell in line, it was a triumphant thing. And the ozone hole has slowly been closing over the last 30 years since that was signed, the Montreal Protocol. The deal is that the damage from the CFCs was 40 or 50 years in the making before they ever figured out what it was. This stuff's been going on for decades. So in so many ways, we are at the mercy of this biosphere we live in. We are just one species in here. And the most remarkable thing to me is the awareness of one or two or three or four facts. They are these. There are four other factors that we depend on for our very existence. You have the Earth itself, right? All that's contained with that, the planet and the dirt that we grow our food in, and all of that, the actual rocks itself, the actual Earth. And then you have all that swims, crawls, walks, and flies, all the animals and the birds and the fishes that we depend on for our food sources. And then you have everything that's green and growing, from the mightiest redwood to the tiniest lichen, all that helps clean the air and keeps all that moving. And then you have us, right? Then here we are. We're a factor in that. Those other things don't need us, but without them, we don't live the lives we can. And so every time we screw around with this stuff, I'm starting to sound like Hooper from Jaws. You keep screwing around with this stuff and you're going to blow something up. You keep screwing around with things and eventually there comes a tipping point in everything. Everything has a tipping point. I was talking a little bit earlier about the first Earth Matters with Bill Curtis we did, which totally spells out what I'm talking about. And here it is.
From the surface, they look clean enough, the rivers that run through the cities and towns of America. But a recent study by the EPA shows that high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen are putting the 1.2 million miles of streams and rivers surveyed under stress. The past 44 years have brought stricter regulations on what corporations can dump into our waterways, that the latest EPA study shows that 55% of the streams and rivers surveyed are not suitable for aquatic life, mostly due to fertilizer runoff, rendering these arteries of Earth sterile. You can do your part by using organic fertilizers on your lawn and in the garden, because the old adage that what goes around comes around isn't just a cliche. It's a way of life or death, especially when it comes to our water supply. I'm Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
In that one-minute piece, we talk about the very lifeblood of the planet, the water we depend on for our very lives. You can go without food for a while. Try water, not going to happen. And as the demand for water grows, as there's more and more of us, as we use water for things that, like golf courses and God, fountains and things, who knows, we're literally getting to the point, over time, slowly dying of thirst. I have an old tape somewhere, it would take me forever to find it, of Bill on my show in Michigan and the late Senator Paul Simon, who, great guy, did a lot of shows with the senator. He was an environmental advocate. And he was talking about being on a cruise ship with his wife way back in the day, and they were enjoying a beautiful evening, probably going from Miami to wherever, you know, the islands, and they were all of a sudden started all this garbage in the water floating, and they wondered where all this garbage came from, and they realized it was just being jettisoned from the cruise ship we're on. They just throw it in the water. And that prompted him to really turn his time in Congress as an environmental advocate. Before that, he really, you know, he was a guy from downstate Illinois, but this was a catalyst for him. It was a pivot point. And he wrote a book called Tapped Out, The Coming Water Crisis in the World, probably around 2000. And he said he started researching the book and he realized at some point that oil will no longer be the most coveted resource, but water will, and that wars will be fought over it. And as soon as people start trucking it from one place to the other or diverting it from one place to the other, we're screwed. Perhaps the biggest offense to me with water is bottled water. When I grew up, bottled water was like an old Coke bottle filled with water you took from the spigot on the side of your house. Somewhere along the line, these major soda companies convinced us that we need to walk around bottles of water all the time.
Marketing is often about getting people to buy not what they need, but rather what they think they need, especially when it comes to the number two beverage sold in America, bottled water. Soda is the number one consumed drink in America, followed closely by bottled water. But what are you really drinking? A 2010 study asked test subjects to rate the taste of water from a bottle versus water from the tap. The conclusion was that the difference was adding minerals for taste. The reality is that 25% of the bottled water sold comes from municipal sources with flavoring added. The main reason for the cost of bottled water isn't the water. It's the amount of crude oil needed to make the bottles, about 17 million barrels a year. Bottled water, the one time water and oil do mix, because it's highly profitable. I'm Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
And if you need to use it, great. Like if you're in Flint, Michigan and your water's shit, then you might need to use it. And then comes the problem of the plastic. You're not paying for the water in there. You're paying for the petroleum process to create plastic bottles. They got really nowhere to go, except sometimes in a landfill. So you can see why I get tired of talking about this stuff to some degree, because you don't know where that breakpoint is. That's the one thing I think that really does keep me going, though, that maybe there's somebody listening that will take some action somewhere. When I mentioned those beads before about all those polyethylene beads, we did three of those episodes, and after the third one, Bill was giving a talk, I think in Cleveland, and he called me from this event he was doing. He said, "You're not going to believe this," in a very Bill Curtis-like voice. He says, the woman of the president of the company he was speaking to came, and had heard those spots we did, the Earth Matters spots, and she said, "You know, it was simple. I just started using soap." Just soap, biodegradable, good old soap. And so that's one action that can be taken on the micro level that may not affect the macro so much, but that's, I think, what happens for people. These problems get so enormous and so overwhelming that we think we can't do anything. And then yet you realize that as a consumer, we drive the market. It's not the other way around. So there was a time that, you know, Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and these places with these fresh food, they didn't even exist. You just got what you got. But the more people demanded different things, the more the market responded. And so I highly doubt that people are going to stop drinking bottled water. I get it. So maybe there's a way to make sure that if you're drinking bottled water, that at very least that you have a recycling plan for that, that there's somewhere they go besides in the landfill. You have to research a little bit, do a little bit of work on it, have a little awareness around it. Because I think this is, you know, it's important stuff. You know, in 2019, Bill and I did an event called Earth Matters, the Science and Spirituality of Ethics in Action. And it was a 90-minute program. I did the first 45 minutes, kind of get worked up like I do now and pounded the podium. And I took the audio from some of our radio shows and I created videos about, you know, showing 100 million sharks getting their fins chopped off every year so some guy could drink soup. Makes no sense to me. But I did show one about the bald eagle, which is a success story. And I think I'm going to, we got to leave on a high note here. The fact that we need to save the bald eagle kind of rubs my rhubarb and torques my bolts, but at least we got it going in the right direction. Back in the 60s, when DDT was a major problem, there were only 417 breeding pairs of bald eagles left in the entire country back in 1963. All DDT was a pesticide. Let's just use that. Nobody knew, putting it on the ground and putting it into the air, that it was going to make the shells of the bald eagle's eggs so thin that they could hardly reproduce. So that was officially banned in 1972, and the bald eagle was given federal protection. Our own symbol of this country had to have federal protection because of a pesticide. So guess what? The people who made DDT, not real happy. So what? Still pesticides out. There's still a problem. But at least the bald eagle has responded. A recent report from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reveals tremendous growth from that bald eagle population that was on the brink, really, of being extinct. I couldn't even imagine that. Can you imagine? I can't imagine. I'm trying to end on a positive note here, but I'm going back to this thing that they were almost gone. And then you would have the symbol of our nation on the Great Seal. And like, well, we killed them all with pesticides. Brilliant. Anyway, as of 2019, there are now over 316,000 bald eagles present in the United States, which is just this side of unbelievable compared to what it once was. As I mentioned, 417 breeding pairs, we are up to 316,700 bald eagles in the United States. That's a success story. But it's no different to me than the polyethylene beads and no different than the CFCs. And it was another man-made, human-made thing that was causing damage. So whenever I hear some, let me clean up my language here, whenever I hear some person say, there's no way that humans can do any damage to the planet. You know, it's just too big. Bullshit. Bullshit. I call that big time. So, thanks for listening to the Earth Day rant. This stuff gets me worked up because I care. And I think all that I'm asking and all that I've ever wanted to get across to people and all the talks I've given and the books I've written and the radio shows I've done is have a little respect for the biosphere and the life support system, because without it, we're screwed. And if you can't look past your own nose, then get out of the way and let the few do the work for the many.
That one river is all. jungle. That one song is all music. All songs are that one. It is the song of life. It is the flower of faith. Of temptation, it is the river of no regret. There is a child that cries in the ghetto. Let this be a voice for the river. Let this be a voice for